Good morning and welcome on to this morning's meeting. Order of business is as per the agenda, unless there's any requests for changes. Nope. Okay. Any apologies?
Apologies from Councillor Imrie, Councillor Young and Councillor Devine.
Okay. Any declarations of interest can be made throughout the day or just now? If we could move on now to item 4, minutes of the previous meeting, I'll go through them. 4.1, 4.2, 4.3, 4.4. Are there any matters arising in any of these minutes? Can we agree them as a correct record? Agreed. Thank you. Item 5, public reports, inspection of St Mary's Primary School and Nursery Class. Grace.
Thank you. The purpose of this report is to outline the outcome of the inspection which happened in St Mary's Primary School and Nursery Class in November and was outlined in their letter from Education Scotland dated the 21st of February this year. This was one of the first inspections under the new How Good Is Our School 4 model, so the quality indicators are different from previously, and the primary stages were evaluated as good across the four main quality indicators, and the nursery stage satisfactory, and the care inspected at gradients for the nursery class are at the bottom of page 21, 3 goods and 1 adequate. The particular strengths which were found by the inspection team are listed on page 21. And we agreed with the inspectorate three main items that we wanted to take forward in terms of next steps. One was to further develop the shared leadership of change across the school and in particular the nursery class, to continue to improve consistency in the quality of learning and teaching and the use of assessment, and also to raise attainment and the level of challenge for all children. It should be noted that the care inspectorate will also do a return visit in 12 months, but we were pleased to say that Education Scotland concluded that they were confident that the school has the capacity to continue to improve, and so Education Scotland will make no further visits. Section 4 of the report concludes with four main recommendations, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Grace. Questions, comments? Okay, do we agree with the recommendations, Jim?
Can I just ask just a quickie on it? On page 27, it talks about a requirement. The provider must demonstrate that staff understand and know how to implement the child protection policy and procedures in order to keep children safe. I presume that's about, it's not about doing, it's about saying that you're doing and recording what you're doing. Am I interpreting that right?
You interpreted that correctly, and I'm pleased to say that requirement has now been met. And we've already fed that back to the care inspectorate, but still, regardless of that, they'll still do the return visit, but you're correct in your understanding.
Thank you. Everyone happy to agree to the recommendations with that? Thank you. Item 5.2, Inspection of Midlothian Residential Services for Young People. Joan?
Good morning. The report is based on an inspection that was carried out in relation to Midlothian Residential Services for Young People on the 28th of October. As members can see, the quality of care and support and the quality of management and leadership were the two areas that were being assessed, and both were advised that they were coming out at very good in relation to them. In relation to the report, there was no requirements or recommendations that were requested following the inspection, and I'm quite glad to see that the efforts of the staff in relation to building relationships, in particular with the young people, but also their families, was noted as being a particular strength within this service. What we need to do better is obviously in relation to the transitions, and this is about children entering the young people's services and also exiting, and making sure that we manage this better in the future. As I'm sure everyone will appreciate, this can always be done on a planned basis due to the difficulties that sometimes arise within these settings. And I've obviously had different conversations with various members in relation to difficulties we've had in the past. However, we do endeavour to maintain these relationships and actually have a duty to ensure that we continue with these relationships under the Children and Young People Scotland Act, where we have a duty of support and care up until the age of 26 now. So, as we can see from the report, there's two recommendations which we're requesting today. Happy to take any questions.
Margot.
Thank you, Chair. Obviously, I can only speak about the Dalkeith House service. There have been a fair few problems in the past as you alluded to, and it's good to see that the Care Commission has given very good to staff, because that obviously must boost staff morale. A bit concerning that there's been issues and uncertainty, but that's always going to be a thing if staff don't know where they're going to be at any given time. So I'm glad to see that there's discussions with senior staff to try and resolve these kind of issues. There have been some issues in our area in Dalkey Town Centre, and the stories are that there's one child who's in Dalkey House who was the ringleader, if you like, but I understand that he, obviously we can't discuss particular issues here, but I'm pleased that what I'm hearing is that that has kind of been dealt with, because there was always an issue when Dalkeith House was built, there was lots of concerns in the local area, but I'm not hearing any complaints now, which is good, because I was, as I say, I was in contact with yourself on many occasions. So it is good to see that there is improvements, and obviously I wish everyone well to ensure that these improvements continue. Thank you.
Jim, then Brian.
I suppose the more we try to establish these residential units as a family environment, a family home, you're going to get issues with the relationships between the staff and the residents. And I had never actually thought about it before, but this issue of taking the staff's, managing the staff sensitively when it comes to ending particular arrangements or introducing things, is something that we've got to be more mindful of. It's something that hadn't struck me, but the more we go into that kind of environment, making it that kind of environment for the young people, then the more we're going to get, I suppose, issues like that. And it's helpful, I think, to have that highlighted here. The issue about giving more consideration to matching young people within the service, understanding through recent conversations the difficulties that we've got in terms of numbers, that's a laudable aim, but the reality, I think, is somewhat different to that. And I can understand the difficulties that we would have in that circumstance, in these circumstances.
I mean, obviously, given the difficulties that we have had recently and we've had discussions around, I mean, we do try, where possible, to plan. And, you know, today we have a children's hearing and we do have a plan. The young person has been to visit the residential house. His family have been up there to visit, but we are at the mercy of the children's hearing decision this morning as to whether that will happen. But that is because we actually have a vacancy today. You know, tomorrow we won't have a vacancy, and if a situation arises. But, you know, I think this has been mentioned because staff do see the children as their own children. They're taking very much on the corporate parenting responsibility, and when you do that you form good relationships, and therefore I think this is why this has been highlighted. So it's actually a positive in amongst everything else, but yes, it's a continual challenge that us as managers need to try and work through.
The report talks about the Care Inspectorate in October 2016, and it's come to our attention now. And just on the timelines, I'm just checking if that was above expectation or below expectation to actually come from an assessment to this committee. And on page 35, it mentions Gorebridge on an address at the front. And is this report specific for Gorebridge? And on page 36, when you turn over, the reporters of the quality of the environment and the quality of staff are not assessed. But on your report on page 2.3, it's got grade 5 and grade 5 not assessed, not assessed.
Okay. In relation to the timing, we have no control over when the Care Inspectorate issue their final statement, and as soon as they did, within a month, then obviously it is presented before here. So we were only presented with the final version 4 weeks ago. And that's a normal period of time. I think they're busy like the rest of us. In relation to the address, we obviously have three different addresses and they choose one. My understanding is that Gorebridge was the final one that the Care Inspectorate was at. That was the one that had the 6 a.m. visits in relation to meet with the night staff. Because we didn't have an overall Midlothian Children's Services address, if you like. And, you know, in relation to what they're assessing at that time, that's only within their gift. It's not within our gift to assess, to say what they need to assess at that time. What do you mean?
On 2.3, it says grade 5 not assessed.
Well, that would be the previous inspection result.
Okay, any other points? I think overall, Joan, given the complexity and the difficulty of doing this kind of work, I think that's a fantastic result to get, and I think that you can pass on your congratulations all round. Okay, is that everybody happy with that? Okay, thank you. 5.3, inspection of High Bank Care Home. Evelyn?
Thank you, Chair. This report outlines the outcome of the inspection of High Bank Care Home. High Bank is, I guess, is a more complex service. It provides a range of services, including respite, intermediate care and interim care. The paragraph 2.2 highlights the strengths of the service that were identified by the inspection team in the inspection. There were no recommendations or requirements for improvement. Committees asked to consider the recommendations in section 4. Happy to respond to any questions.
Thank you, Evelyn. Questions, comments? Ian?
Thanks, David. What's the staff turnover level like at High Bank, and how does it compare with similar homes?
Yeah, I don't have the statistics. I don't have statistics readily available, but certainly will provide you with that. Overall, I mean, older people's social care, there's generally a high turnover relative to some other services like adults or learning disabilities. It's got a much lower level of turnover, but High Bank is not problematic. We have a group of staff there, some of whom have been there a long time and have seen the home through and contributed very positively to many of the changes, because this home changed from being a very small, very traditional council-run home addressing very low-level need and is now at the very edge in terms of the complexity of need. And it also has newer member of staff who've entered it more recently, but certainly a very skilled group of staff who work very closely with NHS colleagues.
Okay. Any other questions? Again, this is a reasonably good, positive report, Evelyn, and congratulations. And if you could pass on your congratulations for the continuing. And if you look through the reports, it has been quite a steady progress and what we would hope for. Again, thank you. Moving on now to inspection of MELDAP. Inspection of shared life in Midlothian.
Thank you, Chair. Just by way of background, Shared Lives is a small service, but an important one. It's an adult placement services for people with learning disabilities, mild to moderate learning disabilities, where the service is provided within people's own home. And you'll see there it provides a range, including daycare, short breaks, but also long-term placements for individuals as well. The inspection report... In 2.4, it highlights the strengths of the service and the quality of care. And in 2.5, highlights in terms of improvement, record keeping, while acknowledging that record keeping standards were high, there were some areas where there were gaps acknowledged. Members are asked to consider the recommendation in section 4. Happy to respond to any questions.
Questions? Ian?
Thanks, Derek. What are the statutory requirements for providing this kind of service? Because it's a sort of low level of service. It's not like sort of care for the elderly, where we have specific requirements that we have to provide a level of service. What is it in respect to this kind of work?
This is a registered service and has to adhere to standards and the same as any other care service. So, and it's only the care inspectorate will only inspect services where it's registered and must comply with standards. It's delivered in a different type of setting in that it's delivered from people's own homes, but it still needs to be compliant in terms of care standards. It's an important service in that it works with people with learning disabilities, and if they weren't in receipt of this service, they would be in receipt of more formal services. And also, because it's people are based within ordinary houses in the community, living with families, it provides a high level of inclusion for individuals who use it. But a very committed group of carers who deliver it, in terms of the families who commit to being involved in this service.
Thanks, Eric. Thanks for that, Evelyn. I'm conscious of the fact that this kind of service provides a tremendous help to people who use it. The reason where I'm coming from was similar to part of your answer there, that if we don't provide this service, then it puts a strain on other areas. And I'm also conscious of the huge cuts that are coming down the way, both for ourselves and the council and also the IGB. My worry is there a situation where we might have to withdraw from this kind of service due to cuts, or do we have to provide it? Obviously, we want to provide it, but that's the area I'm really asking about.
That's a really helpful question. And on the contrary, this is the type of service that we will do more of. And one of the areas that we're certainly exploring at the moment is this service is very challenged when people have more complex needs, and indeed we often end up supplementing it, and it ends up sometimes not being as effective as we would want it to be. But what we're looking at the moment under the programme of realistic care, realistic expectations, is whether we could extend our recruitment specifically for carers who have the skills to be able to deal with people who've got more complex needs. There are some complications around their housing, etc. But this is the type of service that we will do more of, because it's very cost effective in terms of resource and delivers very good outcomes.
Thanks. Last time, honest. That's tremendous. Thanks, Evelyn. There are also other organisations that I've come across. I think one's called Earth for Life. I don't know if you've come across it. I think they help people with learning difficulties, with sort of social interactivity problems, and they help them get in tune with nature, as it were, and they take them out into sort of woodlands and help them to you know, it's really a mental health area. And I'm just wondering if you work with external organisations, charities, social enterprises like that, that are, it seems to be complementary to the kind of thing that this is doing.
Yes, we do. We have lots of examples. We have a local area coordination service that's delivered by Enable, and they work with people in the community, and it's about getting people involved in activities within the community, such as you describe. And that's a very real alternative to much more expensive day centres that involved travel expenses, etc. So a lot of the work that we're doing, not just learning disability mental health, is about getting people engaged in community services. And there's two ends to it. One is where people get something from it in terms of engagement and inclusion, but the other one is where people offer something to the community and make a contribution. And that's probably the biggest impact on people's self-esteem, when people who are disabled are in a position where they feel they're doing something and they're giving something back to their community. So we do fund organisations and activities specifically, because if we didn't do that, we would end up paying for more expensive service. And again, coming back to the work I'm doing around realistic care, realistic expectations, it's about ensuring that professionals are using these type of opportunities as their first point of call, rather than always assuming that it's a more traditional service that's needed.
Okay, any other questions? Evelyn, just one question. I note in the chart that the environment right back to 2009 has never been assessed if you look through the history. And I note it's missing for the graph this time. Is there a reason for that, and have they just dropped us off the whole chart now?
Yes, there is a reason. The environment is people's own home. So it's not like an institutional setting. People who are using these services are living in what is their own home. So the care inspectorate has not applied the standards that you would in a care home to this service. And in actual fact, we had an issue with the care inspectorate in relation to extra care housing, where they were choosing to do an inspection on an environment using care home standards when it was actually people's own homes.
Okay, just to clarify. Yeah. Any other questions, Brian?
Just a brief point, but you know, just congratulating this report, you know, and commenting that is very complicated when you're dealing with people with disabilities, learning disabilities. And I've seen a lot of action in practice with support organisations and daycare packages and advocates getting appointed for people with and this kind of positive kind of outcomes, you know, is very much appreciated. And I'd really like to express my congratulations to the team of, you know, government receiving such an excellent report.
Any other points? Okay, can I just join with that as well? I think if you read through the history, I think the worst you've had since 2009 was one adequate. The rest have been goods, very goods, and you see for here. And 2.3, the quality of care is now at the highest level at 6. And I think to be congratulated, if you could pass on our comments and congratulations to the staff involved. Thank you. Okay, move on to item 5.5, inspection of MILDAP.
Thank you. Just by way of background, MILDAP is the strategic body that commissions services for people who need support around substance misuse issues, and it works across East and Mid. The focus of this report is, while it's across both, but is obviously on Mid. It's what they call a validated self-evaluation, so it's different from other service evaluations, and it looks at the totality of the service, and it did the same inspection across all ADPs in the country at the same time. The focus was very much on the ADPs doing their own self-evaluation, and then the care inspectorate coming in, looking at that evaluation and making judgments about it in terms of what evidence there was. So it was it's quite a different type of inspection, and it doesn't do gradings as such. However, MILDAP were very pleased with this process. And you will see from section 2.7 that it highlighted many of the strengths that we have been developed locally. It was focusing specifically on the implementation of Scottish Government quality principles, the principles that Scottish Government wants to see in terms of the direction of travel and substance misuse services. The strength, and I guess one of the one that's particularly important, is around the success locally in terms of meeting what we call a HEAT target, which is around people getting access to treatment within 3 weeks. And the Mid and East Lothian have consistently achieved a very high level in relation to this target of 98%, and we're the only partnership in Lothian that is doing that. So, and it's really a model that we've done around, we've got gateways to recovery where people can have fast access to support, and particularly in this area that's really important. They've also evidenced the direction of travel in substance misuse service is moving away from a complete reliance on treatment and more to models that are based on recovery. And again, there's good evidence that MELDAP is moving in that direction. The process also involved looking at highlighting areas for continuing improvement, and much of what the care inspectorate identified were areas that MELDAP were already very aware of. Of the 27 suggestions, 19 were ones that MELDAP were already aware of and working on. Members will note the comment around the improvement in Midlothian, that's the premises that's currently used here in Dalkeith, and about the need to improve the physical environment there. But otherwise, it was a very, as I've said, it was a very helpful process, very positive process for MELDAP to engage in terms of highlighting areas of strength, but also endorsing the work that's going on in relation to improvement. Members are asked to consider the recommendation in section 4, but I'm also happy to respond to any other requests for clarification.
Thanks very much, Evelyn. Margot.
Thanks, Chair. I've been involved with the recovery cafes, as you had mentioned, in Dalkeith, and I know quite a lot of the people that are going through recovery, and the excellent work that's been done by MELDAD and all the associated organisations. And there always is an issue about premises, etc., as alluded to in the report. But the peer support seems to be definitely working. I hear people speaking about that. So that element is quite encouraging, as is everything else that they're doing. I wonder if you could expand, though, on the recommendations. 3, support the development of a local recovery hub, which will enable sustainable delivery of high-quality services with Midlothian. Could you expand on that?
Yes, the local IGB had a presentation on this at their development session before last. Basically, it is about strengthening the approach to recovery. It is about recognising the importance of peer support. And we saw that actually in this report. It highlighted the work that a local GP has done in terms of using peer support within the practice. But what we're proposing for a local recovery hub is to have one premises where health, social care staff work together, but also looking at the voluntary sector being in there as well and working together. We're also looking at mental health and substance misuse being co-located, because while not all, but we have significant numbers of people who've got substance misuse issues, but they've also got mental health issues, particularly depression, anxiety and stress. And so it's really about a much more integrated approach around supporting people who've got a dual diagnosis, and rather than having two separate teams and two different offices and people being referred to each other, what we're looking for is having people working together and one plan, and having lots of opportunities in terms of but also working with, the Recovery Cafe will obviously not be located there, but working with things like the Recovery Cafe, etc., very closely. That's key, and we are currently looking at and developing plans for the location in St Andrew Street here in Dalkeith, and they'll be coming forward shortly. But it's the other bit that we're working on at the moment is around strengthening access to detox, community detox, for people who are needing to go through a process of detox, to make sure that we've got the skills and resources to do it locally where that's appropriate for individuals. And that'll be part of the plans as well.
Yes, sorry, Derek. I was answered the question basically when she said St Andrews shortly.
Okay, any other questions or comments? Okay, Evelyn, thank you for that. Move on to 5.6, complaints about Midlothian Council Services. Ian?
Apologies, Chair, because I was not cited. The report informs the PRS Committee of a number of complaints submitted to the SPSO in 2015-16, which related to Midlothian Council services, and identifies any lessons that can be learned from the outcome of the decisions on the SPSO. You'll see under the background the total number of complaints which was considered by the SPSO in relation to the year of 2015-16. And of course, that's the tip of the iceberg in one sense, because most complaints are dealt with either at first or second stage. It's only those complainants who feel they've still not got a satisfactory answer who will then come back and then refer the matter on to the SPSO. And from that, we obviously then receive the responses which the SPSO says following those that the Ombudsman has taken up. In relation to the 20 decisions in that period, then in the case of 10 of those, the SPSO decided them to be premature. In essence, the complainants have to show that they've been through the complete process prior to referring the matter on to the SPSO. If they haven't done so, then the matter's referred back. You'll see of the remainder, all but one were not duly made or withdrawn, out of jurisdiction or outcome not achievable. So at the end of all of that, only one complaint was partly upheld. And in relation to that, you'll see that the following recommendations were received regarding that particular complaint. I won't go into detail on those, but you'll see it relates to a particular issue in relation to education. In terms of the lessons to be learned from that, then in terms of specifically you set out at 3.3 above, which obviously will speak for themselves, I think the issue probably is that it's unfortunate that the number of cases where the complainants were told that they hadn't been through the whole process and therefore it's premature, that's a matter for concern. And I suppose the lesson to be learned from that is that we're as clear as we can be with those making complaints that they really do need to go through the council's full system before there's actually referral on to the SPSO. On that basis, then, Performance Review and Scrutiny Committee is asked to note the number of complaints about Midlothian Council services submitted in that period of 2015-16, the decision in relation to one complaint that was partially upheld, and the finally to ensure that complainants, we redouble our efforts to ensure that complainants are aware that the handling procedures of the council have to be gone through first before this formal review onto the SPSO. On that basis, Chair, happy to pick up any questions in relation to the report.
Thanks, Ian. Brian?
Yeah, my first thoughts is 20 is quite low that's actually went to the Ombudsman, and I don't know, you know, what your experiences are with the other authorities maybe benchmarking on the same kind of size. Housing doesn't surprise me, it comes up, it's the highest. But, you know, is it housing allocations really part of the complaint, you know, that people are pursuing, you know, why was I not allocated a property? You know, is it that kind of housing kind of complaint? And you've mentioned education, but we didn't see education in here in any complaints going to Ombudsman, or is that a separate system of complaints?
Chair, I'm not sure which subject group it would come under. It may have been the only one of its kind in that year, unless unless Grace has information on that.
I think it's not there because one was partially upheld, hence in 3.3 we've gone into detail about that. I think that's why it's not included in the table.
Hi, thanks, Chair. Ian, in terms of the complaints about the... I'm struggling to read this, by the way. Police and fire and police boards. I mean, there is a separate police complaints commission now. That most of the complaints about the police would actually go to, rather than come to Midlothian Council as a board. I mean, have you heard that? Am I getting that wrong?
My understanding is that the complaints through to other public authorities will be routed through their own, so be it the health service, the police, fire, emergency services. My understanding is they're dealt with through their own processes or their own bodies.
Thanks, Derek. I've had a number of my constituents who've referred to issues and said, I complained to the council, but I never heard back. Now, my inclination in their position would be then to take it further, but not to bother to go back to the council about it. In that situation, would that be considered premature, or is there a time limit where you don't hear back from the council and you're therefore entitled to pursue the matter through the Ombudsman?
When a complaint comes in, it is registered formally on the complaint system and then allocated to a particular service, a particular officer. And there are timescales for responding, depending upon the assessment of the complexity of the complaint. So if it's a very straightforward one, there should be a response, I think, within just a few days. If it's going to take longer than the complainant's advised, it could take up to 20 days. My understanding would be that as long as that process is going on, then if a complainant just says, look, I'm fed up, I'm just going to go to the Ombudsman, then the referral back from the Ombudsman would be that it's premature. I would take the view that if an inordinate amount of time has passed and despite attempts to get the council to engage, nothing was happening, my view would be that the SPSO would take a complaint that says the council's simply not responding at all. I just cannot get anything out of them. I think it would be difficult then for an Ombudsman answer to be, well, you need to go through the process. I would have thought there would be, but I'm not aware of cases where we've had that. Hopefully the system is such that they do get answers.
Okay. Any other questions or comments? Okay, yeah, thank you for that. Item 5.7, dog control and dog fouling. Ian, take it up with yourself again.
That's me. In March 2016, about a year ago, this committee considered this matter and agreed that it be further advised of options to increase the capacity to serve fixed penalty notices. That review of options has taken longer than we would have hoped, for reasons that are probably set out in the report, but it is now set out in the report, and I can refer to that in just a short while. Just to provide some context and general update, the number of complaints received by the Environmental Health Service of dog fouling is generally on a downward trend, although you'll see from the bar chart it varies a little bit, but it's generally on a downward trend. Now, while the statistics therefore suggest that the Council's strategy for addressing the issue is having an impact, this is not necessarily a reason for complacency. And I am aware that it may not fully reflect the degree of continued level of great concern amongst some of our communities in relation to what is a pretty dreadful offence which people commit on a regular basis. By contrast, the reported incidents of out-of-control dogs have risen steadily over the past 5 years, and there are new issues coming to the fore, one of which is irresponsible commercial dog walkers who tend to access farmland in a completely uncontrolled way. And at a recent meeting of Midlothian farmers, which I attended, the farmers were very strong in talking about this being a fairly new but rather alarming development which has occurred. Just returning to the review, the details of the options examined is set out in part 4 of the report, the conclusions being that the existing level of dedicated resource be retained in terms of environmental health enforcement officers. There is no capacity within the Environmental Health Service to remove officers from other duties. The range of statutory duties which we have to cover is such that there's not ready slack in the system to bring other officers into play with other activity. The use of officers from other services, particularly waste management and land and countryside, has been looked at in some detail with a pilot scheme that we looked at with land and countryside services. It's just not so seen to be practical or likely to be effective. It leaves the only option in terms of recruitment of more dedicated staff, but there is no budget for that, and therefore it's not recommended in this report. But that would be the only, in my view, option to look at potential for increasing the level of enforcement activity on dog fouling and dog control. Adele Ryan is here, the Group Manager of Environmental Health. Between us, we're happy to try and take on any issues or answer any questions, Chair.
Yeah, it's good to see it's coming down, but, you know, again, I'm trying to define that. You know, if dog fouling, that the actual act of dog fouling, you know, get actually somebody witnessing a dog fouling and leaving it, you know, is if that's the total criteria of the complaint kind of start, or is it dog foul? Because dog foul seems to be the increase that more people are finding, even dog poo bags and litter and more reports of dog foul in streets and back lanes and parks, you know, where the foul's been left, you know, and does this also include the complaints of people raising this as an issue? I see dog foul here, you know, or is that included in the dog fouling kind of stats? And obviously the worst offender is somebody who actually bags it and throws it in a bush, you know, when they think nobody's looking, you know, rather than just take it up to the bin or to take it further afield. And I know that's part of the act, and that's an illegal activity, you know, but I'm just wondering if there's any of them kind of cases getting pursued, and any of the kind of cases is in our stats, or does this come into our litter stats, perhaps?
Thank you, Chair. I can confirm that in relation to the dog fouling complaints that are recorded and are listed in the report, that when a member of the public contacts us with all those scenarios that you have described, including the throwing of bagged waste, they are caught within these figures. The only thing which may be caught, which is not reflected in these figures, as if, for example, a member of the public contacts us to say that I would like a new bin, or I think we should have a dog bin in our street, but actually just now the street is fairly clear of fouling, so we will classify that as a waste management call and send it to Waste Management Services. But if they say, I think we need new bins and there is fouling in our street, that will be incorporated in our statistics here. I fully share your concerns in terms of the disposal of bagged dog waste. It is equally an offence, as you correctly state, under the legislation. And if we can identify anyone committing that offence, we will issue the fixed penalty on that individual as well. The difficulty is people don't tend to throw it when there are other people around. They tend to carry it for a period of time. To try and overcome that, we've done a variety of things through both overt and covert surveillance, because it's quite clear if the enforcement officers are readily visible, people pick up. So we've used the RIPSA processes and we've done covert patrols to try and pick this up in terms of identifying those. And we encourage the public to try, when public come on to us, we encourage the public to try and give us as good of information as possible in terms of the potential offender and the potential times that they walk their dogs, because most people are creatures of habit when they're dog walking. They tend to go on the same type of route. Because of their lifestyle commitments, they tend to go at the same times of day. So we pick up all of those.
Thanks, Chair. I couldn't agree more about the dog bags. I mean, it really does my head in when I see them lying. It's almost better not to pick it up and put it in a bag, because it will eventually disintegrate. But if it's in a bag, it's there for a long time. But I got contacted with Penicuik Rugby Club recently about the dog fouling on their pitches, and I got in touch with, it was actually James Kinch, and they actually put some additional signs up, which are great, but unfortunately dogs can't read. And I mean, people are still taking their dogs onto the pitches. I just wondered, I know there's only the two officers, but is there any way they could do maybe a proactive sort of a pilot scheme, and, you know, areas where we know that this is happening, and, you know, there is signage up to say it's an offence, and, you know, mornings and sort of early evenings would probably be the kind of two peak times for most of the folk taking their dogs out, and just, you know, if one or two could actually be caught and dealt with, I think it might send a message out that, you know, that this isn't what you should be doing, because it shouldn't be on the pitches with dog fouling. I just wondered if there's any way that you could maybe look at that. I know the numbers are limited, but even, you know, an hour either side is sort of the main working part of the day. Wouldn't it be a massive time-consuming project, and it might actually just make a bit of a difference?
Again, I share with you, I concur totally with your concerns in relation to the matter. In terms of the dog fouling on pitches, I personally find that particularly unattractive in terms of, you know, these pitches are there for our young children to go exercise, play, lead healthier lifestyles, and yet the irresponsible dog owners, and you're quite right, it's the irresponsible dog owners. I suppose I might disagree slightly in terms of whether it's worse to just leave it or whether it's worth to bag it and then leave it, but either way it's an offence, and either way we will serve a fixed penalty if we can in relation to that. Again, what we have done in the past and what we intend to do in the future is we recognise it's not 9 to 5 that people walk dogs. You know, the vast majority of dog walkers are, you know, 6, 6:30. As it gets earlier, later in the day, the dog walking community come out earlier, and it pushes on into night time, both ends of the day. We've just recently again started a more focused investigation in terms of the areas that we do, because what we have been doing recently is very much reacting to complaints that come in. So if someone rings up and says Dalkeith, Lonehead, wherever, whichever area, we will actively patrol there, we will ask them to try and identify the perpetrators, and we will check our signage to determine whether or not we can add any additional signage. Of course, we get into the business about blindness if there's too many signs, but we still assess the signage. And we'll try and cover any area where we receive complaints from. What we've just done is we've gone back to a programmed cycle of where we are and making our way right around the district, while still taking into account the complaints we're receiving, to make sure that we're spreading our resources correctly right across the authority area.
Any other questions, comments? I think it's all very well saying that complaints are doing 60%. I'm going to say, if you're walking about out there, complaints might be doing 60%. Dog fouling in the streets and other parts of that certainly isn't it. If anything, I think folk have just gave up complaining. I actually find the report quite disappointing that we've went along to waste services and to land services people and says, look, can we not do something here? It was actually the same guys who came forward with a report some years ago that says that other staff in these divisions should be authorised to do this. I take, for example, waste services. I think you've got something like 4 or 5 supervisors here. I fail to understand how they can't be trained to deal with this. It's the same in land services. You have a high grouping senior supervisors and that, how they can't be trained up to deal with this. Because whilst there's going to be an effect, as your report says, on staff having to attend court as witnesses, that will be far and few between times, because I would assume if you're getting them trained, you will also have cameras that they will be using to help evidence this as a sole worker or a lone worker, or could be doubled up in potential areas. So I'm quite disappointed that you're back here saying that there was a 3-month pilot and nothing happened. Because the reality is, whilst it's really disturbing to us and to the public to have to watch and mix this, number one, it's your bin men and guys like that walking along the pavements every single day that are usually the most victims of it. And in land services, it's the guys walking along with the fly mowers and the strimmers and that end up getting covered in the stuff. And when, horrendously, a lot of dog users, as Adam points out, throw these bags away, it's mainly the guys in land services that actually have to go round and pick this stuff up. So I think we really need to be doing a wee bit more here to actually defend and protect the worker at the coal face here. And it is really disappointing that what we're saying here is you have all these supervisors and none of them at all can be trained up. There's no capability at all. There's no expansion. That everybody's so committed to their own job that effectively that they haven't got any time to be doing this. I would have thought that part of this would be caring about our own staff and making sure that we didn't have guys going around having to cut the grass that are having to, this stuff sprayed all over the place and have to go out and pick up these bags. Because effectively, once there becomes an epidemic in them, which there always does, it's the guys that have to get sent out to do it, and they're not the highest paid members of your staff.
If I may respond to that, just I too concur. You know, I'm fully on board in terms of this. I find this unacceptable that any member of the public leaves their dog fouling, and we are continuing with an environmental health to devote significant resource to try and overcome this. I sympathise fully with the landscape chaps who are out there and regularly come into contact with this and, you know, get their machines covered themselves, whatever. The initial basis of the study that we undertook was before there was a lot of time and effort and resource dedicated into the training aspects, because it would be irresponsible of us as an authority to grant these powers to authorise someone under this legislation without having fully trained them. But the principal thing was this four-month period in which we gave an opportunity for people to come back to us and tell us any incident they had witnessed that could have potentially led to a dog foul and fixed penalty notice being served. And we were very specific about the types of information that we needed. It wasn't just a matter that they'd seen somebody in the distance, but, you know, they had to be able to get to that person, to approach that person, to find the right information. And regrettably, despite their desire to assist in terms of making their work and life better, not having to deal with it on a daily basis, they could not establish any occasion in that four-month period whereby fixed penalties would have been servable. And that is the struggle we find, as I've already indicated. The irresponsible members of the public are very clever at hiding their irresponsible behaviour. And it's the, in my opinion, I think the better option for us is to go back to the covert, ununiformed, lower key to try and establish these people. And we'll certainly be taking that forward through the environmental health processes.
Okay, Adam.
So just on that, I mean, I do understand that I'm a dog. I've got my own dog, right? Now, it doesn't get in the public park. I don't let him go anywhere near it. But in terms of the somebody dog fouling, is corroboration needed, or can one person actually report it? Because that, obviously, if somebody sees somebody on their own. And there is a reluctance to go and approach somebody because at least my dog didn't do anything. You know, everybody's the same with their own beast. But I mean, what is the actual criteria if you want for a fixed penalty? Can one person report it? Because it's one person's word against another, isn't it?
A fixed penalty can be served where an authorised officer of the council gathers the evidence. A member of the public reporting information to us to say that Mr X at such and such an address allowed his dog to file yesterday morning at 7:15 is insufficient for us to serve a fixed penalty. However, what we will do if people come forward with that information is we will go and we will talk to Mr X. And you're right, we often get a lot of flannel, if I can use that word, in terms of it isn't my dog, I don't do it, I always pick up. Or we get a lot of abuse. The environmental wardens who deal with dog fouling matters receive a lot of verbal abuse. It rarely goes beyond that, but verbal abuse. So when any officer, authorised officer, witnesses the event, they can serve a fixed penalty, provided the individual will engage with them to provide name and address, etc. And we have a very good relationship with the police. We've done information sharing exercises with the police before. We've done patrolling with the police before. And we have a local agreement whereby if our environmental wardens are out and are discussing a matter with someone who refuses to cooperate with them, the police will always try and assist and will always try and attend, be it to the middle of a park or whatever, and do attend and have frequently attended to assist us with that matter as it goes forward. If a fixed penalty is served and is challenged under the legislation, and it must be challenged before it can go to court, it must be formally appealed. If it's just ignored, it doesn't, we can't take it forward to court. But if it is formally appealed, we can take it forward to court. That is when we need corroboration to follow through the normal Scottish corroboration processes, which is why when we have campaigns going on, we send officers out in twos, or we double up with the police to go out with a council officer and a police officer to try and give us the best quality, because I'm of the mind if we can get a case to the courts that we can get successful prosecution for, that we can then publicise, that will assist us in our case in this fight. We have sought legal advice before as to whether we can report fixed penalty offences publicly, and we've been told we can't because of the legal issues in terms of appeals and things, so there has to be a degree of fairness associated with that.
Okay. Any other questions or comments? Okay, thanks for your attendance.